Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us. Now, take a listen.
First of all, everybody grab a map.
That's the voice of Bita Becker. Now, you're going to meet her in a moment, but you will hear her suggestion to grab a map throughout the show today, because we are bringing you stories from several different locations. So, do you have your map? Good. Now, look at the western United States, where Colorado borders Utah, which is hugged by Nevada to its west and Arizona to its south. Follow that western edge of Arizona as it kisses California all the way into the bordering nation of Mexico. And you've just tracked the hardest working river in the country, the Colorado River. The Colorado River is responsible for 90% of water for Las Vegas, more than 80% for Tucson, and big portions of the supply for Los Angeles and Denver. The Colorado River supplies water for 40 million people, irrigates 6 million acres of land, and generates more than 4,000 megawatts of hydropower from its dams. The Colorado fuels a $1.4 trillion annual economy, and without it, none of the major cities of the southwestern United States could even exist. Also, the Colorado River is drying up. The Colorado feeds Lake Mead, the nation's largest man-made reservoir. And Lake Mead is now only 35% full. That's the lowest level since it was created nearly 100 years ago. Last week, the federal government declared the first ever water shortage for the Colorado River, and mandatory cutbacks began immediately. The effects will be far-reaching. Joining me today to explain how we got here and what's ahead is Bita Becker, an attorney with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. Bita, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. It's an honor.
And also with me is Brad Udall, Senior Water and Climate Scientist at Colorado State University. Brad, welcome to The Takeaway.
Melissa, great to see you, and Bita also.
Now, Brad, before we get into all of the details, can you just begin by helping our listeners to understand what is the importance of the Colorado River to this region and also maybe more broadly?
So the river supplies water to 40 million different Americans in seven states, and there are two nations, and importantly, there are 30 tribes that rely on this water. It goes to every major city in the American Southwest. It's 90% of Las Vegas's supply, 50% of Phoenix, 50% of Denver. 4.5 million acres of irrigated ag depend on this river. It's really hard to overstate how important it is to this part of the country.
Brad, walk us back a bit. How did we get here?
I mean, you can go back 100 years if you want to when the Colorado River Compact was signed in 1922, and perhaps that's the logical place to start here. The river was allocated at that time between the upper basin, the four states of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, and the lower basin, Arizona, California, and Nevada. Importantly, there were a number of players not at the table when the river was allocated. The environment was not at the table. The tribes were not at the table. Recreation was not at the table. And so what they did back then was, using, frankly, pretty crummy data, over-allocated the river. And this didn't matter for close to 100 years, call it 80 years, it didn't matter, because we didn't have the capacity to actually take all that water out of the river. But starting around 2000, we actually did have it. And something else happened in 2000, which is climate change started to affect the flow of the river. So since 2000, the flow is actually down 20%. So between overuse and a reduction in water supplies, we're now at a critical crunch point. And what's happened since 2000, the two largest reservoirs in the United States, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, they were 90% full. Flash forward to now, they're 30% full. We've drained 60% of them. That's 2 years worth of flow. And we're on our way, frankly, to draining them completely if we're not careful here. So there's a whole series of challenges around this. including the tribal one, which is figuring out how to do right by them, many of whom have never had a water right. And there's an enormous set of issues here to resolve.
And Bita, maybe you can also sort of dig in on the same question and help us to understand the critical significance, particularly to Indigenous communities.
So we're talking about drinking water, agri-water, all types of water use, plus energy use. The reason I point that out is because for many tribal communities, Navajo included, we have regrettably a high poverty rate. The hydropower is the cheapest power we can buy. So when hydropower gets threatened and then we have to go out and purchase higher cost power, we're just further impacting the challenges that our people are facing all at a time of COVID-19. One practical issue is that there's still a high level of water insecurity among tribal people living in the basin. For instance, on the Navajo Nation, it's estimated 30 to 40% of homes lack piped water, which is one of the reasons there was such a high outbreak of COVID-19 in Indian communities. The other aspect to raise is the spiritual, religious, and cultural nature of the river. That is also impacted. So just a cultural core of many, many people who lived in this area forever.
Maybe give us even just one example so that our listeners can understand, if they're not in these communities, sort of what that sense of something that was forever being critically threatened, what that means.
First of all, everybody grab a map and look at the border between Arizona and California. There are five tribes along that stretch of the river who have long lived there. And one of them is named the Kokopah tribe. And what the way they tell their story is, you know, the center of their universe is their river. The center of everything they believe in is the river. So when the river dries up or goes away, you're taking out kind of the center of their being. But what I also want to emphasize is it's not just true for people living in the United States, as Brad mentioned, it also serves Mexico. And so the river for a long time has dried up in Mexico. So not only does it affect the modern economics, which are so critical to daily life, but it also affects that, just that center of being, one's purpose of life.
So Brad, help our listeners to understand a little bit about the kind of day-to-day. What will the cutbacks mean so that as we're looking at this long arc, right, as we're thinking about the capacity for survival and maybe an equitable survival, what will these impending cutbacks mean?
So the first cutbacks are primarily imposed on the state of Arizona. And over the last 100 years, an enormously complex body of law and Supreme Court decisions and regulations have been put in place. And those rules, called the Law of the River, for some odd historical reasons, impose on Arizona the vast majority of these initial cuts. And so it means a number of farmers in central Arizona won't actually get water 2 years from now. Next year, they'll maybe get half of what they were going to get otherwise. They're going to go back to pumping groundwater, which is completely unsustainable in Arizona. And that's a whole nother problem. As this continues, though, and I think we have every reason to believe these cuts will continue out into the future, other entities are going to receive cutbacks as well, including ultimately the state of California. Ag users use about 70% of the water in the basin, and they're going to face the initial hits on this. That's one aspect of this. The reservoirs, unfortunately, are going to continue to drop to very low levels, including, as Bita hinted at earlier, probably loss of power production out of the upper reservoir, Lake Powell, maybe as early as next year. So there's a whole series of cascading impacts, including what likely are going to be some permanent, not just temporary, permanent shortage reductions, shortages in deliveries to users. Municipal users, at least for a while, are going to get off and not face too much of an issue here. But in the long run, I have to tell you, I think, you know, we're going to get to rethink again how we're using every last drop of this river.
I'm actually a little worried to hear you say, Brad, that sort of endpoint consumers may not feel it right away, because so many of the communities that the two of you have described, farmers, indigenous communities, right, are the ones that oftentimes can be most easily forgotten, you know, rendered invisible by our policymaking, especially, right, if my personal water bill isn't going up, if I'm not experiencing a personal shortage. So, Bita, to your point about maybe allowing a moment like this to also constitute a pivot, a head knocking together pivot for how we ought to be engaging, are there ways that you would like to see shared sacrifice in order to move us more swiftly towards a more equitable future?
You know, I think shared sacrifice really begins with, you know, as you were saying, institutions, but also the individual recognizing their role in all of this. These issues aren't new, as Brad is saying. These issues aren't new. I mean, obviously, people have been preparing for this, and I think that's the good news. There are a lot of good people who have been preparing for this. I think your question is, how do we make this real for somebody living in Los Angeles or Albuquerque who's still watering their lawn, right? Like, why do you have a lawn? I think if we can figure out a way to take the reality of COVID that hit everybody, even people who deny it, it hit them, right? If policymakers can figure out a way to make that connection, that emotional connection, and I realize I'm being very lofty here, but I think I think the actions of Congress infusing all of this funding, because that's a huge issue. That's a huge positive step in the right direction, meaning Congress is doing what it can to infuse, to play its role by infusing funding, infusing certain policy direction to get people, so people have the resources they need to focus on resilience. So the language we use, Melissa, is less about sacrifice and more about resilience.
So Brad, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
People in cities are going to be asked to contribute to this, no question about it. In order to resolve this, everybody's at the table. We will need continued municipal conservation. And I think what you're hinting at is a new ethic around water use. And you know, a real appreciation for what happens when you turn that tap on. Not just mostly when you turn the tap on nowadays, you don't even think twice about it, right? I mean, we ask people where their water comes from and they say the tap. Well, yeah, kind of, but not really. You know, it comes from nature. Nature's going to bat last here. And ultimately, it's going to enforce upon us some fundamental changes for everybody. And one good thing, and I'll share some of Bita's optimism in the Colorado River Basin, is that there's a really good working group of people that has, you know, 100 years of working out issues, and especially over the last 20, a lot of cooperation, a lot of understanding. Here in this community, we understand what it means to take water away from farmers or what it means to ask Phoenix to conserve. And that's where I get my optimism, is the people that are working in this, and they understand each other's sensitivities and needs.
Brad Udall is a senior water and climate scientist at Colorado State University, and Bita Becker is an attorney with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. Thank you both for being here, and thank you both for shedding some light and optimism on a story that could feel very panic-driven. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Melissa.
My great pleasure to be with both of you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now, if you've seen the show Superstore that ran on NBC, you know that most of the storyline revolves around the many labor issues affecting its characters. Most of the time, the workers are trying to unionize, while management tries to prevent those efforts.
Studies show that employees at a non-union facility are more engaged and happier.
Yeah! Don't try to come between me and Cloud 9. That's my bae.
Well said.
Recent reporting from the American Prospect tells the inside story of real-life anti-union action in a plant-based meat substitute company in North Carolina, known as, and I swear this is true, No Evil Foods. Workers at No Evil Foods started a union drive in early 2019, and before the vote scheduled in February of 2020, management hired a consulting firm that specializes in union avoidance, and then they held mandatory meetings for employees. Here's one No Evil Foods manager talking to workers in one of those meetings.
So why am I making all these points about the importance of investment dollars? Well, because it's a very real risk that having a union at No Evil Foods will greatly impact our ability to continue raising capital, which risks the survival of our business.
Last month, David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the recent article, Anatomy of an Anti-Union Meeting, walked me through the union drive at No Evil Foods and what has happened to workers since.
So No Evil Foods is a vegan, plant-based foods company, and their workers organized to have a vote on whether or not to join a union. The vote was in February of 2020, right before the pandemic. And prior to that, No Evil Foods, in association with a corporate consultant that specializes in union avoidance, did a series of mandatory meetings for all employees, which were pitched as sort of informational sessions to explain what union membership would be all about, at least from management's perspective. And this is a very common technique that's done during union drives. And I got to listen to about 5 or 6 hours of these meetings, and they were absolutely fascinating to hear the way in which it's almost a kind of psychological warfare that the company engages in to make the workers feel like a union would not operate in their interests.
Part of what was so stunning about your piece is, as you say, there is audio. We can actually listen to it. It's not just what the workers are reporting to us, but we can hear for ourselves. How in the world did you get this audio?
Well, workers taped it is the answer while they were forced to sit in these meetings. And we don't normally hear it. I mean, usually even union organizers are not allowed to be on site. It's employee only meetings. And sometimes you get snippets here and there and you hear about it, but this, to be able to hear 5 or 6 hours of it, you get, you know, these frames that keep coming up again and again. And one of the perfect examples is just this idea that there are employees and employers, and there's this nice, happy family relationship, and then this third party union comes in and is going to ruin everything. And almost the structure of these very tense mandatory meetings, this tension being built, you know, there's a relationship between that and the union almost being seen as the cause of that tension, which can only be relieved by voting it down.
You know, one of the claims that No Evil Foods was making, that I could hear them make in the audio, is that, you know, there wasn't enough money coming in revenue yet to be sustainable. So they had to get investors, and that if the union came in, they might lose investors. Is there any extent to which that's true, that they were informing their employees of something maybe their employees didn't know?
That's really skirts the line of being legal. I mean, it is illegal for an employer to say that if a union comes in here, we're going to shut down. So it was kind of clever the way that they sort of got that impression across the workers. They said, we're not going to shut us down. But our investors who help carry the business, they might pull out their money and that might shut us down. So it's pretty problematic to me to have that be the message taken away from this union drive, because there really are laws against saying that you're going to shut down a business if the workers decide to use their collective bargaining rights. The idea that a startup company cannot afford to treat their workers well is almost in some ways belied by what No Evil Foods was trying to do. They did offer health benefits. They did offer a wage that was higher than the average wage in the region. They were able to provide this. And from the perspective of the workers, They just wanted the ability to organize so that they could have some say in how things were conducted in the workplace and some job security on the back end. And of course, that proved to be very prescient.
Indeed. And so let's talk about that timing a bit, because whatever else, whether it was on the line of being illegal, it certainly ended up being effective, right? Workers voted down the union just before the start of the pandemic.
That's correct. Yeah, they voted it down by a pretty wide margin.
And do you have a sense that that decision was based primarily on what they had come to understand from these so-called informational meetings?
From what I know of talking to workers who were organizers, they were fairly confident that they had the votes to form a union prior to these meetings. And after it, all of the people who were on the fence just went in the other direction.
So obviously then the pandemic hits, and what happens to the workers?
There were questions about whether they could continue in very close quarters. No Evil Foods offered workers a pretty bad set of choices that had to be made within 24 hours, offering some severance money if people wanted to quit, but they would have to sign a non-disclosure agreement that would hold No Evil Foods harmless from a variety of potential violations, or they could stay. And there would be some hope of a pay increase later down the line, but only if workers had perfect attendance for 90 days. About 13% of the workers took the buyout. Many of the top organizers ended up being fired, claiming violations of work rules. One of them was because a woman was told her shorts were too short. So, you know, it seemed to be some retaliation. There was a settlement with the National Labor Relations Board that No Evil Foods had to pay $40,000 to two of the workers who were fired. And then the sort of coup de grace at the end here, in June, every worker at the plant in North Carolina lost their job. No Evil Foods decided to outsource the production of their products to a separate manufacturer and eliminated the need for this workforce. So obviously, if there was a union, there would be a negotiation, there would be warnings. Workers were given absolutely no notice. They didn't get any severance. And all they got was a flyer for a job fair in the area. That was the only thing that they received. So it was almost sort of the perfect way of showing how important a union job would have been to a group of workers.
David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the recent article, Anatomy of an Anti-Union Meeting. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We asked No Evil Foods for comment on this story. Their response is posted at thetakeaway.org.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
And let's turn now to West Virginia.
Find a vein, drain the black gold. Hoping to God that the timbers hold. Like my father before me, it's all I know. We live only to harvest the coal. To harvest the cold.
The song you're hearing? That's Louise Mossery's Battle of Blair Mountain, and it's telling an American story you may not have heard. Where 100 years ago, an interracial coalition of coal miners initiated the largest labor uprising in American history. Working conditions in the early 20th century mines were deadly. For a young man in West Virginia, it was safer to be drafted to fight in World War I than to go to work in the mines. For decades, these miners, some white men, some European immigrants, some black Southerners, demanded the right to organize, to earn higher pay, and to improve safety conditions. Tensions erupted when up to 10,000 miners marched to confront the mining companies and touched off the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Red bandanas that tell us what side you're on. Yeah, we're the rednecks of the Union 1921. We leave tonight 13,000 strong and take the fight to Blair Mountain before the dawn. Before the dawn.
Local law enforcement and hired deputy forces battled the miners for more than a week. And the Battle of Blair Mountain did not end until federal troops arrived and the miners surrendered. In the short term, the companies were victorious. Hundreds of miners were tried and imprisoned. But the coal miners of West Virginia were not defeated. Resistance and organizing continued for more than a decade, and by 1935, they won the right to unionize. With me now to explore the continuing importance of the Battle of Blair Mountain is Charles Keeney, author of The Road to Blair Mountain. He also serves as vice president of the Friends of Blair Mountain and is a history professor at Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College. Professor Keeney, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
For those who are unfamiliar with the Battle of Blair Mountain, can you tell us a bit more about what initiated it?
Well, the initial spark, or the kind of straw that broke the camel's back, as they say, came from the murder of Sid Hatfield and Ed Chambers, two local law enforcement officers in Mingo County who had stood up for the miners and opposed evictions of the miners from company houses. So after Hatfield and Chambers were murdered, you had some very significant things that were happening in Mingo County, which was this kind of beachhead for the unionization efforts in southern West Virginia after World War I. Miners were living in tent colonies, their families were starving. The state troopers came in, attacked the tent colony, stole all the food, and would not allow the UMWA to send in more food and supplies. And then they rounded up all the coal miners and put them in pens. Then when the one law enforcement officer who had stood up for the miners was murdered on August the 1st, 1921, 5,000 miners congregated on Charleston, where my great-grandfather, Frank Keeney, told the miners that the only way you can get your rights is with a high-powered rifle. He then told them to go home and await the call to march. In between Mingo County and Charleston, where they left, there was Logan County, which was another notoriously anti-union county, and they had to try to break the defenses that were placed along Blair Mountain and ridgelines that stretched for about 12 miles. The battle went for 5 days and was fought on a 12-mile front, but the miners were never able to break through Don Chaffin's defenses.
Tell me a little bit more about your great-grandfather, Frank Keeney.
My great-grandfather grew up on Cabin Creek, West Virginia. That's the home of famous NBA basketball player Jerry West, but before then, it was just coal country, and my family lost their land to the coal industry, which many families did during that time. The biggest inhibitor to economic development in Appalachia is absentee land ownership. They lost their land. He started working as a trap boy in the mines just after the age of 10. He made his way only to the sixth grade in school, but he self-educated. And during the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike of 1912 and 1913, he became a leader in that strike, a strike that turned very, very violent, and which somewhere between 50 and 100 people were killed during that strike. But he led the miners to victory. And after that, he was elected to president of the union in West Virginia and president of the West Virginia State Federation of Labor. He was an ardent socialist and rather militant and not afraid to use direct action.
I think as we're speeding towards Labor Day, which, you know, for so many feels like, well, you know, it's kind of the last moment of holiday. You know, some places, schools sort of are marking their beginning there. But I'm not sure that we sort of retell enough in the broadest sense this history of what labor movements really were. I mean, I think it's still jaw-dropping for so many of us that it was this level of violence. These were not peaceful demonstrations in that sense.
No, not at all. And the fact that it was an interracial and ethnic mix of miners, you had around 20% of the miners that were marching were African Americans. About another 30% were recent immigrants that had come over. And this was something that really scared the powers that be. One coal operator said, testifying after the battle, he said, you cannot imagine the terrorism that prevailed. Anywhere one could look, one could see a collared man with a rifle. Those were his words. They controlled 500 square miles of territory. The U.S. Army was brought in. The U.S. Air Service was brought in. But this idea of poor whites, blacks, and immigrants working together, when we know that those groups are often pitted against one another in today's political arena, that scared the powers that be. And that's just, and the Battle of Blair Mountain took place, you know, only around 90 days after Tulsa. So all of that's fresh on the minds of the people that are taking up arms.
Isn't this also part of the beginning of the language redneck?
Right. When you think of the word redneck, of course, most people think of this stereotype. And there are a number of different origins of the word redneck. But coal miners and labor pro-union people began wearing red bandanas in West Virginia. And so coal miners were called rednecks, and that meant you were a union man. If you said the word redneck in 1921, it did not mean anything close to what it means today. It meant you were a union man. There were black rednecks. There were immigrant rednecks. It was a symbol of their union pride. And miners would continue to wear red bandanas through the Black Lung Association in the 60s. And when teachers went on strike in West Virginia, they wore red bandanas just a few years ago. So it has become a symbol of labor solidarity and unionism. But because the miners didn't win the Battle of Blair Mountain, they didn't control the story. And so the coal companies and the media were able to say that the violence was not a product of this industrial autocracy, but rather the violence was this backward, ignorant, moonshine-drinking culture. It allowed people to be dismissive of individuals and the culture here in the region and why there was so much violence to begin with.
All right, let's dig in a little bit. I want to go to this point that you made about absentee landowners. Can you say a few more words about that? Because that sounds like it's an analysis about economic conditions right now, not just 100 years ago.
Right. The economic conditions really haven't changed that much in 100 years. What they did is coal companies tried to come in, and railroad companies, steel companies came into the region after they found out the wealth of coal that was here in the 1880s. And of course, many people were already living on the land. And in order to get to the land, companies came up with something called the broad form deed, which enabled them to buy mineral rights. And so they could buy the land underneath. And so the land was stolen by these out-of-state corporations. That means several things. Number one, locals don't control the land and they don't control their own economic destiny. And it also means that the wealth that is generated in West Virginia doesn't stay here. And so, you know, there's billions and billions of dollars that have been made every year from coal, but none of it stays in West Virginia, or a very, very small percentage, which is one of the reasons that the place is mired in poverty. And the problem with that is the industry is able to control school curriculum and media around here and tell people that the only reason that you even have an economy is because of coal, as opposed to being the only reason you don't have any wealth is because of coal. So they're able to flip the script because they've been able to control the narrative since the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Say more about that control of the narrative as a historian, as a writer who is uncovering this and telling this story, which is both a family story, a community story, but also our national story. What were you taught in school?
Nothing. I was not taught at all about the mine wars in school. I learned from my family. The coal industry created something called the American Constitutional Association right after World War I, and they used that to control school curriculum in the state of West Virginia to deliberately take the mine wars and all labor struggles out of textbooks. For example, the largest industrial disaster in U.S. history took place in West Virginia, the Hawk's Nest disaster, in which nearly 800 people were killed, most of them African Americans, and where they were dumped in unmarked graves. This was in the 30s. Nobody knows about that outside of West Virginia because it's just been deliberately taken out of the textbooks. And if you understand that this is a history that's been erased, you begin to understand the worldview and the mentality of the people have here. I call it the mind guard system. You had the mind guard system, this police state that the coal companies used in the early part of the 20th century. Now I say they have the mind guard system in which they're able to control news, school curriculum, and information that people get and really shape their worldviews.
As you're talking about this, I'm thinking about the current debate raging around critical race theory. And I'm thinking, huh, I wonder if it's actually more dangerous to a system of inequity to teach critical race theory, or at least as it's presented in these partisan battles, or to actually teach that there was an interracial coalition of working class people who rose up and saw their combined interest.
Right. America's labor history, and more specifically the Battle of Blair Mountain, challenged the very tenets and the very ideals tied with the American dream or the concept of the United States. Is it anti-American to challenge the capitalist system? Is it unpatriotic to take up arms against your company? So in many ways, this conflict that's started out being waged in the coal fields and is now waged in classrooms is in many ways a conflict over the very ideals of what America is and should be. And we need to insert race and labor and gender and those things into the classroom so that students are more equipped to better understand what's going on and understand why things are the way they are.
Is that part of why you are a founding member of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum?
Yes, for several reasons. We created the Mine Wars Museum in 2015, and this was a number of activists and scholars and some union coal miners and locals in Matewan, West Virginia, who joined together. And we wanted to create a grassroots people's history museum to rectify the fact that this is a story that's left out of the classroom. If the institutions aren't going to tell the story, then we're going to tell the story itself. The industry wanted to destroy this history so much, they tried to actually destroy the Blair Mountain battlefield with mountaintop removal coal mining. And the Mine Wars Museum came from a number of activists and scholars, including myself, that led an effort to stop the industry from destroying the battlefield. We were successful in that effort. And that's a lot of what my book is about, and about that mentality that is in the coal field, because this history is simply not a part of the consciousness.
If someone were to visit the museum, what would they see?
You would see a number of different things. I have, for example, a poetry book that my great-grandfather had while he lived in a tent colony in 1912 and 1913. You see bullets that were fired on the Blair Mountain battlefield, things like scrip that the companies used to pay the miners. They weren't paid in American money. There's one particular piece of scrip that I just love that it just really symbolizes everything. And that's, it's a piece of scrip that says, "Good for one loaf of bread." And if you're a per individual and you got paid with that, they're not only dictating that you can't spend American money, but they're dictating to you what you can buy. So when you see that and you begin to be able to put your hands on and touch the actual items of oppression, then you can begin to see why these miners were so militant and why they became so violent. It's not this backward, you know, feuding, moonshine drinking culture, but rather people that had just been pushed too far.
You all are planning a big celebration for Labor Day?
Yes. The Mine Wars Museum has formed a coalition with other groups called Blair 100. You can check out the website at blair100.com. And there's 4 days worth of events. The United Mine Workers is going to be reenacting the entire armed march, all 50 miles that weekend. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 events. Much of that was going to be available online for people who can't travel or may not want to due to the Delta variant. But it's going to be a lot of events. We've already had a couple of online events, but you can go to blair100.com and check that out. You can also go to the Mine Wars Museum's YouTube page and see some videos we have about it, as well as a video that tells people what's going on with the Blair Mountain battlefield today.
Just one last question for you. So it's been 100 years. I did hear you say a bit earlier in our conversation that very little has changed about the economic circumstances of folks who are living in these communities. What might be possible in the next 100 years? What are some of the steps that need to be happening now so that 100 years from now, there's not a historian saying, well, and it's still about the same?
Right. Is there a reason for hope? And yes, there is. I call it in my book, identity reclamation. Whenever the coal companies blast a mountain, they do what's called reclamation afterwards, in which they're supposed to kind of put the mountain back together, which is a big joke. You can't really fully redo your identity if it's been scarred and manipulated for generations. But what you can do is try to pick up the pieces and begin to take control of your narrative. That's one of the things that the Mine Wars Museum is doing. And in doing so, we believe that we are empowering younger generations to take control of their own destiny. When we started our little museum 6 years ago, the little town of Matewan, there was nothing in the town. All the stores were boarded up. All the buildings were abandoned. Now 5 new businesses have opened up in the town. And this little tiny place is beginning to thrive again because of heritage tourism. So there are ways in which we can begin to seek alternative economies here. But it begins, I think, with education. It begins with the new generations coming up that is not have their ideology forced upon them or dictated to them by the coal industry or what they see in local, corporate controlled media.
Charles Keeney, author of The Road to Blair Mountain, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Melissa, thank you so much for your interest in the story.
Before we head out, though, let me give a quick shout out to our fantastic team that helps make all this radio happen. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Lydia McMullen-Laird, Shanta Covington, and Katarina Barton. Our line producer is Jackie Martin. Vince Fairchild is our board operator. Jay Cowett is our sound designer. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.